May it please the court. Damian Stone on behalf of the appellant, Thomas Lawton Roberts, and I intend to reserve 5 minutes on the reply. We request that this court reverse the jury verdict and also reverse the district court's directed verdicts and the dismissal to negligence claim. The trial court errors deprived Lawton Roberts of a fair trial, and we make this request based on three primary reasons. Number one, that the jurors who expressed clear biases were not rehabilitated. Number two, the plaintiff presented well in excess of prima facie evidence to support each of the claims that were either dismissed or granted directed verdicts on. Number three, the plaintiff was prevented from using material facts that would support his substantive claims. With respect to the first issue, the Court of Appeals stated in People v. Hancock, in the face of clear statements of bias by a juror, deference to the trial judge is not given by the court. Instead, it's recommended that the trial court engage in a three-part process. The first is to either recognize that the juror held a deeply seated bias and dismiss that juror for cause. The second one is to follow up with rehabilitative questioning that elicits rehabilitative answers. And the third one is, if the court denies that challenge for cause, it has an obligation to state on the record as to that specific juror why he is disregarding that statement of cause or that statement of bias. And the Court of Appeals and People v. Zamora elicited a little bit more of what types of rehabilitative responses are required. And it's also reflected in the People v. Hancock case. And the juror needs to make statements that they're going to follow the evidence and they're going to consider that evidence solely in reaching their verdict or their decision in regard to liability. In addition, they have to state that they're going to follow the jury instructions. Now, in this case, Ms. Brownstein, Mr. Critter, and Ms. Dennis never made those rehabilitative statements, and they also were never engaged by the court in rehabilitative questioning or by any other counsel. And therefore, this affected a substantial right on behalf of the plaintiff. And the court has said in Blaze that the failure to grant a proper challenge for cause reduces the peremptory strikes of the party and requires a new trial. So in this instance, it's a reversible trial, not just for all three, but for any of the denials for cause that the court failed to grant.
So you have three. Yes. Isn't the trial court in the best position to assess the credibility of the potential jurors? And couldn't the trial court in this instance have concluded that Ms. Bronstein, was really interested in attending to her business, and that's why she was trying to get out of jury service? And why shouldn't we defer to the trial court if that was the case?
Because the court clear said in the Court of Appeals case, People v. Hancock, is when you have those clear statements of bias, you can't defer to the trial court. And this court is required to review that entire voir dire in its entirety. And specifically, Ms. Brownstein made some very clear statements of bias that had nothing to do with her business. She stated she was concerned for being impartial. She didn't know how impartial she could be. She also explained that she was sympathetic to the defendants. And she was specifically asked, "Do you really believe this is a case you can sit on and be impartial?" And she responded, "I don't think it is, I'm sorry." And then she was asked and said, "I think it would be fairest to the plaintiff to be excused. There is no clearer statement of bias that I've come across in the case law that I've read than what was stated by Ms. Bronstein. And if that's not a basis to remove somebody for cause, there is no basis to do it. And it's just going through the motions." And Mr. Critter and Ms. Dennis also have equally biased statements. Mr. Critter said that he felt the bar had no duty to protect anyone, that he could not accept a person attacked at the bar. It would not be their fault. And then also Ms. Dennis said it's not the owner's responsibility to prevent everything, and there was no rehabilitative questioning done. The court had an obligation under People v. Hancock to walk through that process. And in fact, the court stated that this isn't a big burden that the Court of Appeals is placing on a trial judge. It's actually part of their job. And his failure to do it, he abrogated his responsibilities to ensure that there was a fair trial for the plaintiff.
At any time did the court ask those jurors or the panel generally whether they would follow the instructions of law?
There was a reference in the briefing, I believe, maybe a general question, but I can't recollect 100% as I'm standing here in front of you. And I think the requirement would not be fulfilled by making a general statement, hey, is everybody going to follow the jury instructions? And nobody responds one way or another. It disregards, I think, common human interaction when you're in a group setting. You're not necessarily going to respond one way or another if you're not that type of person. The Court of Appeals in Hancock required the judge to specifically ask that juror if they're going to do it. Otherwise, there's an ambiguity, and nobody on this panel or anybody in this courtroom today can answer that question whether they would or wouldn't. So that takes me to my second reason, which was the trial court erred in granting the directed verdicts. Colorado Supreme Court stated in Rocky Mountain Hospital that after the presentation of prima facie evidence to support your claims, it's up to the jury to make that decision as to the merits of those claims. In discussing what prima facie evidence means, the court cited to the opinion by Justice Scalia. And Justice Scalia said, prima facie evidence is any evidence that creates an inference to support that claim. So that bar is very low. And in the briefing, I made pinpoint citations to direct testimony from Robert Moore, Ms. Newman, and also plaintiff's expert, Lane Kottmeyer, to support each one of the elements of the dismissed claims or the directed verdicts claims. And then in response, the defense has argued, well, it doesn't really matter because the jury verdict came back as no finding of liability. And my response to that is directing this court to Bannock v. Thomas, where it talked about harmless error and what is reversible error. And in that case, it said reversible error is when the error affects a substantial right, when you can say with fair assurance that it substantially influenced the outcome of the trial or affected and impaired the basic fairness of the trial. And in this case, that certainly can be said to be true. Here, at the beginning of the trial, we had two defendants, Newman LLC and LNH LLC. And the plaintiff presented evidence that both of those companies were run by two of the same people, were run by the same people, Laura Newman and Holly Morrison. And the plaintiff asserted the same claims against each defendant, the same facts, and the same arguments. So when the trial court, midway through the trial, granted directed verdict in favor of one of the defendants, and yet the face of the defendant was still remaining at the table for the rest of the trial, and the dismissed defendant's attorney was allowed to give a closing argument, it certainly sent a message to the jury that plaintiff's claims had no merit. And it can be said with reasonable assurance that those directed verdicts affected the ultimate outcome of that trial. This trial was over at the directed verdict stage, if not at the jury selection stage, when the judge would not allow us to engage in a fair trial. That brings me to my third point, which is that the court prohibited us from submitting material facts. And this is important for us in the context of this trial, and it also affects any litigant bringing these type of claims against the business. And from our perspective, it involves a question of law because you're dealing with material evidence or material facts that the Colorado Supreme Court, as well as this court, has identified in Brazil as being necessary to support a foreseeability and should have known argument in the context of third-party criminal acts. In Taco Bell and Brazil, the court identified as important to support those types of claims, police statistics, crime statistics for that particular property, crime statistics involving businesses around that general vicinity, and also the general crime statistics of the neighborhood.
Well, in Taco Bell, weren't the evidence of other crimes, robberies, which was also the crime that resulted in injury to one of the patrons?
That was one of the crimes, but also in the decision, the court said it didn't have to be the specific crime that was involved in that particular case. Instead, it could be any type of crime. And the reason for that is anybody who's been involved in the criminal justice system is because any of those crimes can lead to a murder. You can have a pickpocket or some other smaller crime that spins out of control and leads to a robbery or leads to more of a significant crime. So the court specifically said, regardless of the type of crime, the crimes in general are relevant to the foreseeability because it transfers that new or should have known knowledge to the owner.
Did your crime statistics include any assaults on the defendant's premises?
Yes, it did, Your Honor. That was excluded. 2003 assault was excluded.
Wasn't there other evidence came in of the 2003 assault?
I don't believe so. I don't believe so. If it was, it would have been overruled by the court. The court was very explicit. And we had 22 different crimes occurring on that property that were excluded.
Well, was there only one assault?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And then there were a lot more assaults in the, there was a comparison we wanted to present to the jury of the businesses within one block radius. The defendants were allowed to present testimony by their expert in security that they went and visited all these other bars and some of them didn't have doormen, etc. And we wanted to present to the jury, well, Herbs has 1,000% more crimes than these other particular bars that he's referencing. And we were also prohibited from introducing that. I see that I have 4 minutes left, if I can reserve that in reply. Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is John Coates, registration number 8925. Here on behalf of Laura A. Newman, LLC, doing business as Herbs, and I'll just refer to it as Herbs. Also present is Randy Sago, who is here on behalf of L&H, LLC, which is a landlord entity in which Herbs' business is operated. Mr. Sago will address the issues with respect to the directed verdict issues and the dismissal of claims after directed verdict time relating to joint venture. I'm here to respond to any questions of the court and to address the other issues in the case with respect to jury selection, evidence admission, and whether premise liability was the sole correctly instructed claim in this case. Taking the issues in the order that Mr. Stone presented them, with respect to the jury selection, the question is whether the process is so tainted that there's an abuse of discretion by the court and its determination that these jurors could be fair and impartial. I think this issue hinges on this kind of question that we're kind of babbling around here, is whether there is an unambiguous, strong statement of bias such that the analysis cited by Mr. Stone and Hancock would require a reversal of this case. And there isn't any such thing, apparently, as a direct harmless error solution for this problem in the current state of the Colorado's law, as I understand it. So I think the question is, if you can't find, if you find a clearly unequivocal statement of bias, then this issue becomes problematic. I think a search of the record indicates that there is no such statement of unequivocal bias. Yes, ma'am.
Why wasn't it an unequivocal statement of bias for Ms. Bronstein to effectively say, you know, in response to whether, based on her personal experience as a businesswoman, woman business owner, she believed it was feasible for her to serve and be impartial, and she said, I don't think it is, I'm sorry. And she herself was admitting that she had a bias in favor of other female business owners.
I believe she stated that bias. I think it was an appropriate comment for her to make. As I recall, the statement was along the lines, you know, I'm not the best juror for this plaintiff, words to those effect. But even her most strong statements of bias were couched in these terms of something less than absolute, I would suggest. And I think you got to look at every question and every, the whole process as a whole. Particularly understanding that the judge had spent specific time in the record, I think it's in volume one on page 15 through 17, specifically address the very objections that are here on appeal directly for each one of Critter, Bronstein, and Dennis.
But then, wasn't the lower court mistaken when he said that Ms. Bronstein had been rehabilitated?
I don't believe he was mistaken.
Well, where can we find in the record any specific rehabilitation of her statement? As my colleague points out, that I can't be impartial.
I don't think you're going to find anything in the record where the judge goes, can you follow the law and instructions specifically to Mrs. Bronstein to find that? But again, the court's approach was, well, wait a minute. She's just trying to get off this jury. Her problem is associated with her work, as was Dennis, as was Credit.
Well, did the judge make that statement specifically as to Ms. Bronstein, as opposed to making that statement concerning the other two prospective jurors?
I'm not certain he said it specifically as to her, but I think if you look at the record at page 215 through 18, volume 1, disc 4, you're going to find that in the context of all three of those, when he's considering those issues for cause, he does address that issue.
Well, let's assume that that's true. If a prospective juror makes an unequivocal statement of bias, can the lower court simply disregard it by saying they're just trying to talk their way off the jury without there being any rehabilitative questioning by the court or counsel?
No, I don't think the court can ignore it. I think the court has to take an unequivocal statement of bias, and our current jurisprudence has to find that a motion for cause will be granted.
Okay, so your position is that her statements were not an unequivocal?
Correct. Okay. In the context of the whole thing, that is.
So, Mr. Coates, could you follow up on that and tell us what was not unequivocal, or what was equivocal?
Your Honor, again, I without reading her statements, when I review the record, and I think in the brief, we categorize those statements pretty directly. When you're voir dire a jury and somebody gets up and says, hey, as a woman owner, and I'm worried about being unfair to her because I'm a woman business owner. Well, why is that even a statement of bias? It's a correct statement that here's an issue, folks, that may affect my jury service. A number of the issues relating to what are bias are not really statements of bias. They're comments elicited by the court, by the jurors provide, that don't suggest at all they can't serve as impartial jurors, but are simply stating to the court, hey, these are the issues you've asked me to talk about, here they are. And these particular three jurors did that. They talk about a person saying, hey, I'm worried about a plaintiff's participation in a bar fight. Well, how is that a statement of bias? I'm worried about a bar owner being responsible for anything. Again, is that really a statement of bias? So again, I think if you in the jury selection process, and keeping in mind Judge Whitney was well involved in it, is in a position to assess whether these folks are just trying to get off the jury. We're talking a 2 to 3 week jury, and in the process of the selection, that became a critical piece of what was going on in that process. Now again, if Judge Whitney had not looked at these folks and not looked at them individually and ignored them and just said, hey, I don't care about this issue, that'd be one thing, but that's not the record.
Well, let me shift a little bit. In addition to statements of bias, there's the ability to follow instructions. And my understanding is one of the jurors, I think Ms. Bronstein, was indicating difficulty about following certain instructions, and I understand in your briefing you were saying that had been resolved, and I was going to ask you to point to how had that difficulty been resolved.
The instruction of law piece in the minutes that I had there at L&H's counsel, and I don't know whether it was Lasser or Sago, at page 197, lines 4 to 7, was our cite to a question, to the panel in general, can you follow the law and instructions? I didn't have time to go through and find more statements. The overall instructions themselves require the jurors to follow the law and instructions. And again, the panel that heard this trial, of course, let's not forget, had no problem with following the law and instructions. This is a non-constitutional issue. It's not it's clearly harmless error in the sense of, did the jurors who actually decided this case have any issues of bias or prejudice that Mr. Stone was referring to? The answer is no.
But I mean, under McCrander, isn't reversal automatic if we conclude that the plaintiff was forced to use a peremptory on a juror that should have gone out for cause?
Sadly, it is. I believe you folks have no authority to impose a harmless error standard, although that is what should occur in this case.
Okay. So you're not arguing harmless error under the existing?
We've cited to the harmless error, but again, it's not binding precedent. It's 10th Circuit, it's United States Supreme Court, it's those other jurisdictions. I think there's, well, again, it's not in our briefs and stuff, but there's many jurisdictions that have gone the way of the harmless error.
Okay.
With respect to one statement on the, if I've adequately responded to your questions, one statement on this evidence issue. This court did allow evidence of other crimes. It carefully analyzed that those ought to have something to do with Herb's and something to do with bar fights and fighting. It's not correct to say it was a blanket exclusion of other crimes evidence. Officer Dorn testified specifically concerning fighting in the area.
Was there also specific testimony about the 203 assault in Herb's?
There is, Your Honor, but I think the state of the record is that there was an objection. It had been excluded pretrial. There was an objection at trial. The jury heard that there had been a person hit with a bottle on the patio at Herb's in 2003, but an objection was sustained. So the status of that evidence would be it's not part of the record, or as far as the jury was concerned, it was sustained. They obviously heard the question. But again, we're back to there are no specific instances of violence and fights at Herb's that were relevant to be shown. That particular incident was remote in time, and the court ruled correctly that it, in character, it had nothing to do with the circumstance here where a person who unknown becomes involved with Mr. Lawton without any notice, without any provocation other than a couple of words over which the persons at Herb's had no knowledge whatsoever. Chief Montgomery was permitted to talk about crime in that area. And in the transcript, the court specifically said, hey, if you want to talk about bar fights and fighting, put on your evidence. But you are not going to put on just general crime evidence that's not specific or relevant or obviously would involve sideshows that wouldn't necessarily be appropriate for the case.
What's your response to your opposing counsel's argument that under Taco Bell, the other crimes need not be the exact same type of crime?
I disagree with that statement as a key or even a significant comment in Taco Bell. Taco Bell involved 10 robberies at the same place within a three-year period. Evidence that got into trial may have included other crimes in the area, etc. As part of this overall, this is a horrible neighborhood, but that was not a controlling factor in that case, I believe. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Randy Siegel, and I have the pleasure of representing LH LLC. I hope to discuss today with you the issue of joint venture, as well as the trial court's correct decision to direct a verdict in favor of LH at the close of the plaintiff's case under the facts and evidence that had been presented. Initially, the discussion here, I think, is academic in light of the jury's verdict. If this court does not disturb the jury's verdict, then what the judge did on directed verdict is really irrelevant. Now, Mr. Stones made an argument that a directed verdict in favor of one defendant at the halfway point somehow affects the substantial rights of the plaintiff. That's just not the case. That would prevent any directed verdict where you've got more than one defendant at all times. Here, I'll also point out in the record, the judge instructed the jury when he told the jury before giving the jury instructions, he instructed the jury and informed them that L&H had been dismissed. It was something that I, the court, did, and you are not to take any inference from that. There was no objection to that advisement. The plaintiff made no further attempt to clarify that or any objection to it. So I don't think it's fair to say today that that somehow affects the substantial rights because one defendant who was entitled to a directed verdict got a directed verdict. If this court, and like I say, I do think it's academic because you can't have vicarious liability on L&H if there's no liability on Herb's to begin with. Herbs, and the jury correctly concluded, based on the evidence that it was presented, that there was no danger, and they also concluded that in the jury verdict form, that there was no danger that Herbs knew or should have known about. That's conclusive as to L&H as well. The only claim here, as I understand it from the plaintiff, is there's a vicarious liability on L&H as a result of some joint venture.
Well, doesn't the plaintiff also argue that there was at least sufficient facts for the jury to find there was joint operation between sufficient joint operation that either Newman LLC or L&H could be deemed the landowner for PLA purposes?
Well, there is the argument that he made at trial that it was a joint venture. That was the argument made to the judge, and the judge and the trial court there rejected it.
Okay, but didn't he also argue that L&H, notwithstanding the lease, L&H retained sufficient practical control because Ms. Newman made all the decisions for both entities, that L&H, the jury could find L&H was still a landowner for PLA purposes?
I'm not sure that he made that argument. I would say that there's no evidence to support that argument if that argument was in fact made. But here the evidence that they presented was that Newman had two hats. Newman had the hat as Newman LLC is hers, and also was a member in L&H.
Wasn't she the managing member of both entities?
No, she would have been, she was the managing member, if you will, of the LLC Herbs.
Okay, who was the managing
member? Holly Morrison was, I'm not sure who was actually dedicated as the managing member, but I think both of them. I think the arguments that they made at trial and the evidence showed more that Holly Morrison was in charge of L&H, did all the bookwork for L&H, did all the landlord type duties for L&H. So I think that was where they were at to begin with. I'm running out of time, but I would like to address simply that there was no evidence whatsoever of any intent to form a joint venture here. The parties clearly said that their intent was not to form a joint venture. They formed an LLC for the exact purpose of being a landlord and a tenant. Under Wilson and all the PLA cases, the premises liability cases, the possession was transferred to the tenant, and the tenant did all of the work at the site. Also, this landlord exercised no control whatsoever over the instrumentality of what the plaintiff claims was his injury or caused his injury. And that's key under Norton versus Madden, as well as the other Wilson case. And what, I see I'm about out of time, so if there are no further questions for me, ask the court to affirm the jury's verdict as well as the court's decisions. Thank you.
Just wanted to apprise the court that my co-counsel Tom Matera is also here with us today. Wanted to respond to those three points raised by the defendants. The first one deals with the joint venture and Your Honor's question about the claims that we asserted against L&H. In addition to the joint venture claims, we did also assert the PLA claim and also a negligence claim against L&H. And you had specifically asked about Laura Newman's involvement as the managing member of L&H, and she did testify that Laura Newman, as a owner of L&H as well as Newman LLC, agreed to make that property safe. She also testified that she made staffing decisions as a member of L&H and Newman LLC. She testified she was aware of the dangers associated with operating that bar before entering the lease. And certainly in our arguments before the jury, we argued that L&H was a authorized agent of Newman LLC, and under the Wilson requirements, when you're talking about exclusivity of control, that would fall into one of the exceptions, how a landlord could still be considered a property owner under the PLE.
Well, under the
PLA.
Under the LLC agreement, who was the managing member of L&H, if you recall?
I do not recall.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And then we also had testimony that there was mutual control over both of the defendants, and they shared in the profits and losses. And that came from Lane Kottmeyer as well as Ms. Newman. With regard to the joint venture issue, I did want to touch on one issue that I thought's important, and that is the idea of an instrumentality requirement associated with the joint venture claim. And I would ask this court to address that on a remand. The defendants had argued that LH had to be part of the instrumentality, so to speak, that caused the injury. And I direct this court's attention to the Bebo construction case for the proposition that there is no instrumentality requirement in a commercial joint venture context. The law has made a clear distinction between commercial joint ventures and then also joint ventures involving automobiles and instrumentalities, and that difference is delineated in 7:21 and 7:22. And it's also shown in the Bebo construction case. In that case, you had a plaintiff bringing a legal malpractice action against a Maddox law firm. In addition, they identified as a defendant Excel Corporation, and Excel was a construction corporation, and they just provided technical know-how and also funding to the law firm. So they were not part of the quote-unquote instrumentality providing legal advice to the plaintiff, and yet they were considered by the trial court, the Court of Appeals, and the Supreme Court as a joint venture. And the rational explanation for that is if you're operating a commercial business, you're deriving benefit from the overall operations, and you can't say, yeah, I'm going to take all the benefit, but if something bad goes wrong, I don't have any liability because I didn't pick up or start that machine myself or pick up the gun or whatever it may be. And that's why there's a distinction with regard to the instrumentality involved in an automobile or a gun or a piece of machinery where two people might meet at a certain time and then engage in one specific act. I see I'm running out of time. I ask that this court reverse the jury verdict and also reverse the directed verdicts and dismissal of plaintiff's negligence claim and correct the errors and injustice that occurred in the trial court for Mr. Roberts. Thank you.
We appreciate the arguments of counsel. The case stands submitted. We will issue a written opinion in due course.